heard Morgan Sloat's dying scream as he was driven back through all the worlds that were into oblivion. "Jack?" Richard was sitting up woozily, holding his head. "Jack, what happened? I think I fell down the stadium steps." Speedy was twitching in the snow, and now he did a sort of girl's push-up and looked toward Jack. His eyes were exhausted, but his face was clear of blemishes. "Good job, Jack," he said and grinned. "Good." He fell partway forward again, panting. "Rainbow," Jack thought woozily. He stood up and then fell down again. Freezing snow coated his face and then began to melt like tears. He pushed himself to his knees, then stood up again. The field of his vision was filled with spots, but he saw the enormous burned swatch in the snow where Morgan had stood. It tailed away like a teardrop. "Rainbow!" Jack Sawyer shouted, and raised his hands to the sky, weeping and laughing. "Rainbow! Rainbow!" He went to the talisman and picked it up, still weeping. He took it to Richard Sloat, who had been Rushton, to Speedy Parker, who was what he was. He healed them. Rainbow, rainbow, rainbow. Chapter 46. Another Journey. He healed them, but he was never able to recall exactly how that had gone, or any of the specific details. For a while, the talisman had blazed and sung in his hands, and he had the vaguest possible memory of its fires actually seeming to flow out over them until they glowed in a bath of light. That was all he could bring back. At the end of it, the glorious light in the talisman faded, faded, went out. Jack, thinking of his mother, uttered a hoarse, wailing cry. Speedy staggered over to him through the melting snow and put an arm around Jack's shoulders. "It be back, traveling Jack," Speedy said. He smiled, but he looked twice as tired as Jack. Speedy had been healed, but he was still not well. "This world is killing him," Jack thought dimly. "At least it's killing the part of him that's Speedy Parker. The talisman healed him, but he is still dying."
"You did for it," Speedy said, "and you want to believe that it's going to do for you. Don't worry. Come on over here, Jack. Come on over to where your friend be laying."
Jack did. Richard was sleeping in the melting snow. That horrid, loose flap of skin was gone, but there was a long white streak of scalp showing in his hair now, a streak of scalp from which no hair would ever grow.
"Take his hand."
"Why? What for?"
"We're gonna flip."
Jack looked at Speedy questioningly, but Speedy offered no explanation. He only nodded as if to say, "Yes, you heard me right." Well, Jack thought, I trusted him this far. He reached down and took Richard's hand. Speedy held Jack's other hand. With hardly a tug at all, the three of them went over. It was as Jack had intuited. The figure standing beside him over here on this black sand that was stitched everywhere by Morgan of Orus's dragging foot looked hale and hearty and healthy. Jack stared with awe and some unease at this stranger who looked a bit like Speedy Parker's younger brother. "Speedy, Mr. Parkus, I mean...
What are you boys need rest," Parker said. "You for sure, this other young squire even more. He came closer to dying than anyone will ever know but himself. And I don't think he's the type to do much admitting even to himself."
"Yeah," Jack said, "you got that right."
"He'll rest better over here," Parker told Jack,
and struck off up the beach away from the castle carrying Richard. Jack stumbled along as best he could, but gradually found himself falling behind. He was quickly out of breath, his legs rubbery. His head ached with reaction from the final battle. Shock hangover, he supposed.
"Why? Where?"
That was all he could pant. He held the talisman against his chest, It was dull now, its exterior sooty and opaque and uninteresting.
"Just up a little way," Parker said. "You and your friend don't want to rest where he was, do you?"
And exhausted as he was, Jack shook his head. Parker glanced back over his shoulder, then looked sadly at Jack.
"It stinks of his evil back there," he said, "and it stinks of your world, Jack. To me they smell too much alike for comfort."
He set off again, Richard in his arms. 40 yards up the beach, he stopped. Here the black sand had moderated to a lighter color, not white, but a medium gray. Parker set Richard down gently. Jack sprawled beside him. The sand was warm, blessedly warm. No snow here. Parker sat beside him, cross-legged.
"You're going to have a sleep now," he said. "Might be tomorrow before you wake up. Won't anybody bother you? If so, take a look."
Parker waved his arm toward the place where Point Venuti had been in the American territories. Jack first saw the black castle, one entire side of it crumbled and burst, as if there had been a tremendous explosion inside. Now the castle looked almost pedestrian. Its menace was burnt out, its illicit treasure borne away. It was only stones piled up in patterns. Looking farther, Jack saw that the earthquake had not been so violent over here, and there had been less to destroy. He saw a few overturned huts that looked as if they had been built mostly of driftwood. He saw a number of burst coaches that might or might not have been Cadillacs back in the American territories. Here and there he could see a fallen, shaggy body.
"Those who were here and survived have now gone," Parker said. "They know what has happened. They know Oris is dead, and they'll not trouble you more. The evil that was here has gone. Do you know that? Can you feel it?"
"Yes," Jack whispered. "But, Mr. Parkus, you're not...
"Going? Yes, very soon. You and your friend are going to have a good sleep, but you and I must have a bit of a talk first. It won't take long, so I want you to try and get your head up off your chest, at least for the moment."
With some effort, Jack got his head up and his eyes all, well, most of the way, open again. Parkus nodded.
"When you wake up, strike east. But don't flip. You stay right here for a while. Stay in the territories. There's going to be too much going on over there on your side. Rescue units, news crews, Jason knows what else. At least the snow will melt before anybody knows it's there, except for a few people who'll be dismissed as crackpots."
"Why do you have to go?"
"I just got to ramble some now, Jack. There's a lot of work to be done over here. News of Morgan's death will already be traveling east, traveling fast. I'm behind that news right now, and I've got to get ahead of it if I can. I want to get back to the outposts and the east before a lot of pretty bad folks start to head out for other places."
He looked out at the ocean, his eyes as cold and gray as flint.
"When the bill comes due, people have to pay. Morgan's gone, but there's still a debt owing."
"You're something like a policeman over here, aren't you?"
Parkus nodded. "I am what you'd call the Judge General and Lord High Executioner all rolled into one. Over here, that is."
He put a strong, warm hand on Jack's head.
"Over there, I'm just this fellow who goes around from place to place, does a few odd jobs, strums a few tunes. And sometimes, believe me, I like that a lot better."
He smiled again, and this time he was speedy.
"And you be seeing that guy from time to time, Jackie. Yeah, from time to time and place to place. In a shopping center, maybe, or a park."
He winked at Jack. "But Speedy's not well," Jack said. Whatever was wrong with him, it was something the talisman couldn't touch.
"Speedy's old," Parkus said. "He's my age, but your world made him older than me. Just the same, he's still got a few years left in him, maybe quite a few. Feel no fret, Jack."
"You promise?" Jack asked. Parkus grinned.
"Yeah, Bob.
Jack grinned tiredly back.
You and your friend head out to the east. Go until you reckon you've done 5 miles. You get over those low hills, and then you'll be fine, easy walking. Look for a big tree, biggest damn tree you've ever seen. You get to that big old tree, Jack, and you take Richard's hand, and you flip back. You'll come out next to a giant redwood with a tunnel cut through the bottom of it to let the road through. The road's Route 17, and you'll be on the outskirts of a little town in Northern California called Storyville. Walk into town. There's a mobile station at the blinker light.
And then? Parker shrugged.
Don't know. Not for sure. Could be, Jack. You'll meet someone you recognize.
But how will we get hush? Parker said, and put a hand on Jack's forehead exactly as his mother had done when he was baby bunting, daddy's gone a-hunting, and all that good shit. La, la, go to sleep, Jackie, all's well and all's well and very small.
Enough questions. All will be well with you and Richard now, I think.
Jack lay down. He cradled the dark ball in the crook of one arm. Each of his eyelids now seemed to have a cinder block attached to it.
"You have been brave and true, Jack," Parker said with calm gravity. "I wish you were my own son, and I salute you for your courage and your faith. There are people in many worlds who owe you a great debt of gratitude, and in some way or other, I think most of them sense that."
Jack managed a smile. "Stay a little while," he managed to say.
"All right," Parker said, "until you sleep. Feel no fret, Jack. Nothing will harm you here."
"My mom always said..."
But before he finished the thought, sleep had claimed him. And sleep continued to claim him in some mysterious wise the next day when he was technically awake, or if not sleep, then a protective, numbing faculty of the mind, which turned most of that day slow and dreamlike. He and Richard, who was similarly slow-moving and tentative, stood beneath the tallest tree in the world. All about them spangles of light lay across the floor of the forest. 10 grown men holding hands could not have reached around it. The tree soared up, massive and apart. In a forest of tall trees it was a leviathan, a pure example of territory's exuberance.
"Feel no fret," Parker had said, even while he threatened to fade hazily away like the Cheshire Cat.
Jack tilted his head to stare up toward the top of the tree. He did not quite know this, but he was emotionally exhausted. The immensity of the tree aroused only a flicker of wonder in him. Jack rested a hand against the surprisingly smooth bark. "I killed the man who killed my father," he said to himself. He clutched the dark, seemingly dead ball of the talisman in his other hand. Richard was staring upward at the giant head of the tree, a skyscraper's height above them. Morgan was dead, Gardner too, and the snow must have melted from the beach by now. Yet not all of it was gone. Jack felt as though a whole beach full of snow filled his head. He had thought once, 1,000 years ago, it seemed now, that if he could ever actually get his hands around the talisman, he would be so inundated with triumph and excitement and awe that he'd have to fizz over. Instead, he now felt only the tiniest hint of all that. It was snowing in his head, and he could see no farther than Parkus's instructions. He realized that the enormous tree was holding him up. "Take my hand," he said to Richard. "But how are we going to get home?" Richard asked. "Feel no fret," he said, and closed his hand around Richard's. Jack Sawyer didn't need a tree to hold him up. Jack Sawyer had been to the blasted lands. He had vanquished the Black Hotel. Jack Sawyer was brave and true. Jack Sawyer was a played-out 12-year-old boy with snow falling in his brain. He flipped effortlessly back into his own world and Richard slid through whatever barriers there were right beside him. The forest had contracted. Now it was an American forest. The roof of gently moving boughs was noticeably lower, the trees about them conspicuously smaller than in the part of the territory's forest to which Parkus had directed them. Jack was dimly conscious of this alteration in the scale of everything about him before he saw the two-lane blacktop road in front of him, but 20th-century reality kicked him almost immediately in the shins. For as soon as he saw the road, he heard the egg-beater sound of a small motor and instinctively drew himself and Richard back just before a white little Renault LeCar zipped by him. The car sped past and went through the tunnel cut into the trunk of the redwood, which was slightly more than half the size of its territory's counterpart. But at least one adult and two children in the Renault were not looking at the redwoods they had come to see all the way from New Hampshire, live free or die. The woman and the two small children in the back seat had swiveled around to gawp at Jack and Richard. Their mouths were small black caves, open wide. They had just seen two boys appear beside the road like ghosts, miraculously and instantaneously forming out of nothing, like Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock after beaming down from the Enterprise. "You okay to walk for a little while?" "Sure," Richard said. Jack stepped onto the surface of Route 17 and walked through the huge hole in the tree. He might be dreaming all this, he thought. He might still be on the territory's beach, Richard knocked out beside him, both of them under Parkus's kindly gaze. My mom always said. Moving as if through thick fog, though that day in that part of Northern California was in fact sunny and dry, Jack Sawyer led Richard Sloat out of the redwood forest and down a sloping road past dry December meadows. That the most important person in any movie is usually the cameraman. His body needed more sleep. His mind needed a vacation. That vermouth is the ruination of a good martini. Richard followed silently along, brooding. He was so much slower that Jack had to stop still on the side of the road and wait for Richard to catch up with him. A little town that must have been Storyville was visible a half-mile or so ahead. A few low white buildings sat on either side of the road. "Antiques," read the sign atop one of them. Past the buildings, a blinking stoplight hung over an empty intersection. Jack could see the corner of the mobile sign outside the gas station. Richard trudged along, his head so far down, his chin nearly rested on his chest. When Richard drew nearer, Jack finally saw that his friend was weeping. Jack put his arm around Richard's shoulders. "I want you to know something," he said. "What?" Richard's small face was tear-streaked but defiant. "I love you," Jack said. Richard's eyes snapped back to the surface of the road. Jack kept his arm over his friend's shoulders. In a moment, Richard looked up, looked straight at Jack, and nodded. And that was like something Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer once or twice really had said to her son. "Jacko, there are times you don't have to spill your guts out of your mouth." "We're on our way, Richie," Jack said. He waited for Richard to wipe his eyes. "I guess somebody's supposed to meet us up there at the mobile station." "Hitler, maybe?" Richard pressed the heels of his hands to his eyes. In a moment he was ready again, and the two boys walked into Storyville together. It was a Cadillac, parked on the shady side of the mobile station, an Eldorado with a boomerang TV antenna on the back. It looked as big as a house trailer and as dark as death.
"Oh, Jack, bad shit!"
Richard moaned and grabbed at Jack's shoulder. His eyes were wide, his mouth trembling. Jack felt adrenaline whip it into his system again. It didn't pump him up any longer. It only made him feel tired. There had been too much, too much, too much. Clasping the dark junk shop crystal ball that the talisman had become, Jack started down the hill toward the mobile station.
"Jack!"
Richard screamed weakly from behind him.
"What the hell are you doing? It's one of them! Same cars as at Thayer, same cars as in Point Venuti!"
Parkus told us to come here, Jack said.
You're crazy, chum, Richard whispered.
I know it, but this'll be all right, you'll see, and don't call me chum. The caddy's door swung open and a heavily muscled leg clad in faded blue denim swung out. Unease became active terror when he saw that the toe of the driver's black engineer boot had been cut off so long hairy toes could stick out. Richard squeaked beside him like a field mouse. It was a wolf, all right. Jack knew that even before the guy turned around. He stood almost 7 feet tall. His hair was long, shaggy, and not very clean. It hung in tangles to his collar. There were a couple of burdocks in it. Then the big figure turned, Jack saw a flash of orange eyes, and suddenly terror became joy. Jack sprinted toward the big figure down there, heedless of the gas station attendant who had come out to stare at him, and the idlers in front of the general store. His hair flew back from his forehead, his battered sneakers thumped and flapped, his face was split by a dizzy grin, his eyes shone like the talisman itself. Bib overalls, Oshkosh, by gosh, round rimless spectacles, John Lennon glasses, and a wide, welcoming grin.
Wolf! Jack Sawyer screamed. Wolf, you're alive! Wolf, you're alive!
He was still 5 feet from Wolf when he leaped, and Wolf caught him with neat, casual ease, grinning delightedly.
Jack Sawyer, Wolf, look at this, just like Parkus said. I'm here at this god-pounding place that smells like shit in a swamp, and you're here too. Jack and his friend, Wolf. Good, great, Wolf.
It was the wolf smell that told Jack this wasn't his wolf, just as it was the smell that told him this wolf was some sort of relation, surely a very close one.
I knew your litter, brother. Jack said, still in the wolf's shaggy, strong arms. Now, looking at this face, he could see it was older and wiser, but still kind.
"My brother, Wolf," Wolf said, and put Jack down.
He reached out one hand and touched the talisman with the tip of one finger. His face was full of awed reverence. When he touched it, one bright spark appeared and shot deep into the globe's dull depths like a tumbling comet. He drew in a breath, looked at Jack, and grinned. Jack grinned back. Richard now arrived, staring at both of them with wonder and caution.
"There are good wolves as well as bad in the territories," Jack began.
"Lots of good wolves," Wolf interjected.
He stuck out his hand to Richard. Richard pulled back for a second and then shook it. The set of his mouth, as his hand was swallowed, made Jack believe Richard expected the sort of treatment Wolf had accorded Heck Bast a long time ago.
"This is my wolf's litter, brother," Jack said proudly.
He cleared his throat, not knowing exactly how to express his feelings for this being's brother. Did wolves understand condolence? Was it part of their ritual?
"I loved your brother," he said. "He saved my life. Except for Richard here, he was just about the best friend I ever had, I guess. I'm sorry he died."
"He's in the moon now," Wolf's brother said. "He'll be back. Everything goes away, Jack Sawyer, like the moon. Everything comes back like the moon. Come on, want to get away from this stinking place."
Richard looked puzzled, but Jack understood, and more than sympathized. The mobile station seemed surrounded with a hot, oily aroma of fried hydrocarbons. It was like a brown shroud you could see through. The wolf went to the Cadillac and opened the rear door like a chauffeur, which was, Jack supposed, exactly what he was.
"Jack?" Richard looked frightened.
"It's okay," Jack said.
"But where?" "To my mother, I think," Jack said.
"All the way across the country, to Arcadia Beach, New Hampshire, going first class. Come on, Richie." They walked to the car. Shoved over to one side of the wide back seat was a scruffy old guitar case. Jack felt his heart leap up again.
"Speedy,"
he turned to Wolf's litter brother. "Is Speedy coming with us?"
"Don't know anyone, Speedy," the wolf said. had an uncle who was sort of speedy, then he pulled up lame, Wolf, and couldn't even keep up with the herd anymore.
Jack pointed at the guitar case. Where did that come from?
Wolf grinned, showing many big teeth. Parkus, he said. Left this for you, too. Almost forgot.
From his back pocket he took a very old postcard. On the front was a carousel filled with a great many familiar horses, Ella Speed and Silver Lady among them, but the ladies in the foreground were wearing bustles, the boys knickers, many of the men derby hats and Raleigh fingers mustaches. The card felt silky with age. He turned it over, first reading the print up the middle, Arcadia Beach Carousel, July 4th, 1894. It was Speedy, not Parkus, who had scratched two sentences in the message space. His hand was sprawling, not very literate. He had written with a soft, blunt pencil.
You done great wonders, Jack. Use what you need of what's in the case. Keep the rest or throw it away.
Jack put the postcard in his hip pocket and got into the back of the Cadillac, sliding across the plush seat. One of the catches on the old guitar case was broken. He unsnapped the other three. Richard had gotten in after Jack.
"Holy crow!" he whispered.
The guitar case was stuffed with $20 bills. Wolf took them home, and although Jack grew hazy about many of that autumn's events in a very short time, each moment of that trip was emblazoned on his mind for the rest of his life. He and Richard sat in the back of the Eldorado, and Wolf drove them east and east and east. Wolf knew the roads, and Wolf drove them. He sometimes played Creedence Clearwater Revival tapes, Run Through the Jungle, seemed to be his favorite, at a volume just short of ear-shattering. Then he would spend long periods of time listening to the tonal variations in the wind as he worked the button that controlled his wing window. This seemed to fascinate him completely. East, east, east. Into the sunrise each morning, into the mysterious, deepening blue dusk of each coming night, listening first to John Fogerty and then to the wind, John Fogerty again and then the wind again. They ate at Stuckey's. They ate at Burger King's. They stopped at Kentucky Fried Chicken. At the latter, Jack and Richard got dinners, Wolf got a family-style bucket and ate all 21 pieces. From the sounds, he ate most of the bones as well. This made Jack think of Wolf and the popcorn. Where had that been? Muncie. The outskirts of Muncie, the town line sixplex. Just before they'd gotten their asses slammed into the sunlight home. He grinned, and then felt something like an arrow slip into his heart. He looked out the window so Richard wouldn't see the gleam of his tears. They stopped on the second night in Julesburg, Colorado, and Wolf cooked them a huge picnic supper on a portable barbecue he produced from the trunk. They ate in a snowy field by starlight, bundled up in heavy parkas bought out of the guitar case stash. A meteor shower flashed overhead, and Wolf danced in the snow like a child.
"I love that guy," Richard said thoughtfully.
"Yeah, me too. You should have met his brother. I wish I had."
Richard began to gather up the trash. What he said next flummoxed Jack almost completely.
"I'm forgetting a lot of stuff, Jack."
"What do you mean?"
"Just that. Every mile I remember a little less about what happened. It's all getting misty. And I think that's the way I want it. Look, are you really sure your mother's okay?"
Three times Jack had tried to call his mother. There was no answer. He was not too worried about this. Things were okay, he hoped. When he got there, she would be there, sick, but still alive. He hoped.
"Yes."
"Then how come she doesn't answer the phone?" "Sloat played some tricks with the phones," Jack said. "He played some tricks with the help at the Alhambra, too, I bet.
She's still okay. Sick, but okay. Still there, I can feel her. And if this healing thing works,"
Richard grimaced a little, then plunged,
"you still think she'd let me
you know, stay with you guys?
No, Jack said, helping Richard pick up the remains of supper. She'll want to see you in an orphanage, probably, or maybe in jail. Don't be a dork, Richard. Of course you can stay with us.
Well, after all my father did, that was your dad, Richie, Jack said simply, not you. And you won't always be reminding me, you know, jogging my memory?
Not if you want to forget.
I do, Jack. I really do.
Wolf was coming back. You guys ready, Wolf?
All ready, Jack said.
Listen, Wolf, how about that Scott Hamilton tape I got in Cheyenne?
Sure, Jack. Then how about some Creedence?
Run Through the Jungle, right?
Good tune, Jack. Heavy, Wolf. God-pounding heavy tune.
You bet, Wolf.
He rolled his eyes at Richard. Richard rolled his back and grinned. The next day, they rolled across Nebraska and Iowa. A day later, they tooled past the gutted ruin of the Sunlight home. Jack thought Wolf had taken them past it on purpose, that he perhaps wanted to see the place where his brother had died. He turned up the Creedence tape and the cassette player as loud as it would go, but Jack still thought he heard the sound of Wolf sobbing. Time. Suspended swatches of time. Jack seemed almost to be floating, and there was a feeling of suspension, triumph, valediction, work, honorably discharged. Around sunset of the fifth day, they crossed into New England. Chapter 47 Journey's End. The whole long drive from California to New England seemed, once they had got so far, to have taken place in a single long afternoon and evening. An afternoon that had lasted days, an evening perhaps lifelong, bulging with sunsets and music and emotions. Great humping balls of fire, Jack thought. I'm really out of it, when he happened for the second time in what he assumed to be about an hour to look at the discreet little clock set in the dashboard, and discovered that 3 hours had winked past him. Was it even the same day? Run Through the Jungle, pumped through the air. Wolf bobbed his head in time, grinning unstoppably, infallibly finding the best roads, the rear window showing the whole sky opening in great bands of twilight color, purple and blue, and that particular deep, plangent red of the down-going sun. Jack could remember every detail of this long, long journey, every word, every meal, every nuance of the music, Zoot Sims or John Fogerty, or simply Wolf delighting himself with the noises of the air. But the true span of time had warped itself in his mind to a concentration like a diamond's. He slept in the cushiony back seat and opened his eyes on light or darkness, on sunlight or stars. Among the things he remembered with particular sharpness once they had crossed into New England and the talisman began to glow again, signaling the return of normal time, or perhaps the return of time itself to Jack Sawyer, were the faces of people peering into the back seat of the Eldorado, people in parking lots, a sailor and an ox-faced girl in a convertible at a stoplight in a sunny little town in Iowa, a skinny Ohio kid wearing breaking-away-style bicycle gear, in order to see if maybe Mick Jagger or Frank Sinatra had decided to pay them a call. Nope, just us folks. Sleep kept stealing him away. Once he awoke, Colorado, Illinois, to the thumping of rock music, Wolf snapping his fingers while keeping the big car rolling smoothly, a bursting sky of orange and purple and blue, and saw that Richard had somewhere acquired a book and was reading it with the aid of the Eldorado's recessed passenger light. The book was Broca's Brain. Richard always knew what time it was. Jack rolled his eyes upward and let the music, the evening colors, take him. They had done it. They had done everything. Everything except what they would have to do in an empty little resort town in New Hampshire. 5 days or one long, dreaming twilight. Run Through the Jungle, Zoot Sims's tenor saxophone saying, "Here's a story for you, do you like this story?" Richard was his brother, his brother. Time returned to him about when the talisman came back to life, during the magical sunset of the fifth day. Oatly, Jack thought on the sixth day. I could have shown Richard the Oatly tunnel, and whatever's left of the tap. I could have shown Wolf which way to go. But he did not want to see Oatly again. There was no satisfaction or pleasure in that. And he was conscious now of how close they had come, of how far they had traveled while he drifted through time like a thistle. Wolf had brought them to the great, broad artery of I-95, now that they were in Connecticut, and Arcadia Beach lay only a few states away, up the indented New England coast. From now on, Jack counted the miles and the minutes, too. At 5:15 on the evening of December 21st, some 3 months after Jack Sawyer had set his face and his hopes on the West, a black Eldorado Cadillac swung into the crushed gravel driveway of the Alhambra Inn and Gardens in the town of Arcadia Beach, New Hampshire. In the west, the sunset was a mellow valediction of reds and oranges fading to yellow and blue and royal purple. In the gardens themselves, naked branches clattered together in a bitter winter wind. Amid them, until a day not quite a week ago, had been a tree which caught and ate small animals. Chipmunks, birds, the desk clerk's starveling slat-sided cat. This small tree had died very suddenly. The other growing things in the garden, though skeletal now, still bided with dormant life. The Eldorado's steel-belted radials popped and cracked over the gravel. From inside, muffled behind the polarized glass, came the sound of Creedence Clearwater Revival. "The people who know my magic," John Fogerty sang, "have filled the land with smoke." The Cadillac stopped in front of the wide double doors. There was only darkness beyond them. The double headlights went out, and the long car stood in shadow, tailpipe idling white exhaust, orange parking lights gleaming. Here at the end of day, here at sunset, with color fanning up from the western sky in glory. Here. Right here and now. The back of the caddy was lit with faint, uncertain light. The talisman flickered, but its glow was weak, little more than the glow of a dying firefly. Richard turned slowly toward Jack. His face was wan and frightened. He was clutching Carl Sagan with both hands, wringing the paper back the way a washerwoman might wring a sheet. "Richard's talisman," Jack thought, and smiled. "Jack, do you want—" "No," Jack said. "Wait until I call." He opened the rear right door, started to get out of the car, then looked back at Richard. Richard sat, small and shrunken in his seat, wringing his paper back in his hand. He looked miserable. Not thinking, Jack came back in for a moment and kissed Richard's cheek. Richard put his arms around Jack's neck for a moment and hugged fiercely. Then he let Jack go. Neither of them said anything. Jack started for the stairs leading up to the lobby level, and then turned right and walked for a moment to the edge of the driveway instead. There was an iron railing here. Below it, cracked and tiered rock fell to the beach. Farther to his right, standing against the darkling sky, was the Arcadia Fun World roller coaster. Jack lifted his face to the east. The wind that was harrying through the formal gardens lifted his hair away from his forehead and blew it back. He lifted the globe in his hands, as if as an offering to the ocean. On December 21st, 1981, a boy named Jack Sawyer stood near the place where the water and the land came together, hands cradling an object of some worth, looking out at the night-steady Atlantic. He had turned 13 years old that day, although he did not know it, and he was extraordinarily beautiful. His brown hair was long, probably too long, but the sea breeze swept it back from a fine, clear brow. He stood there thinking about his mother, and about the rooms in this place which they had shared. Was she going to turn on a light up there? He rather suspected she was. Jack turned, eyes flashing wildly in the talisman's light. Lily felt along the wall with one trembling skeletal hand groping for the light switch. She found it and turned it on. Anyone who had seen her in that moment might well have turned away. In the last week or so, the cancer had begun to sprint inside her, as if sensing that something might be on the way which would spoil all its fun. Lily Cavanaugh now weighed 78 pounds. Her skin was sallow, stretched over her skull like parchment. The brown circles under her eyes had turned a dead and final black. The eyes themselves stared from their sockets with fevered, exhausted intelligence. Her bosom was gone. The flesh on her arms was gone. On her buttocks and the backs of her thighs, bed sores had begun to flower. Nor was that all. In the course of the last week, she had contracted pneumonia. In her wasted condition, she was, of course, a prime candidate for that or any other respiratory disease. It might have come under the best of circumstances, and these were definitely not those. The radiators in the Alhambra had ceased their nightly clanking some time ago. She wasn't sure just how long. Time had become as fuzzy and indefinable to her as it had been for Jack in the Eldorado. She only knew the heat had gone out on the same night she had punched her fist through the window, making the gull that had looked like Sloat fly away. In the time since that night, the Alhambra had become a deserted cold box, a crypt in which she would soon die. If Sloat was responsible for what had happened at the Alhambra, he had done one hell of a good job. Everyone was gone. Everyone. No more maids in the halls trundling their squeaky carts, no more whistling maintenance man, no more mealy-mouthed desk clerk. Sloat had put them all in his pocket and taken them away. 4 days ago, when she could not find enough in the room to satisfy even her bird-like appetite, she had gotten out of bed and had worked her way slowly down the hall to the elevator. She brought a chair with her on this expedition, alternately sitting on it, her head hanging in exhaustion, and using it as a walker. It took her 40 minutes to traverse 40 feet of corridor to the elevator shaft. She had pushed the button for the car repeatedly, but the car did not come. The buttons did not even light. "Fuck a duck," Lily muttered hoarsely, and then slowly worked herself another 20 feet down the hall to the stairwell. "Hey!" she shouted downstairs, and then broke into a fit of coughing, bent over the back of the chair. "Maybe they couldn't hear the yell, but they sure as shit must have been able to hear me coughing out whatever's left of my lung," she thought. But no one came. She yelled again, twice, had another coughing fit, and then started back down the hallway, which looked as long as a stretch of Nebraska turnpike on a clear day. She didn't dare go down those stairs. She would never get back up them. And there was no one down there, not in the lobby, not in the saddle of the lamb, not in the coffee shop, not anywhere. And the phones were out. At least the phone in her room was out, and she hadn't heard a single ring anywhere else in this old mausoleum. Not worth it. A bad gamble. She didn't want to freeze to death in the lobby. "Jacko," she muttered, "where the hell are you?" Then she began to cough again, and this one was really bad, and in the middle of it she collapsed to one side in a faint, pulling the ugly sitting room chair over on top of her, and she lay there on the cold floor for nearly an hour, and that was probably when the pneumonia moved into the rapidly declining neighborhood that was Lily Cavanaugh's body. "Hey there, Big C, I'm the new kid on the block. You can call me Big P. Race you to the finish line." Somehow she had made it back to her room, and since then she had existed in a deepening spiral of fever, listening to her respiration grow louder and louder until her fevered mind began to imagine her lungs as two organic aquariums in which a number of submerged chains were rattling. And yet, she held on, held on because part of her mind insisted, with crazy, failing certainty, that Jack was on his way back from wherever he had been. The beginning of her final coma had been like a dimple in the sand, a dimple that begins to spin like a whirlpool. The sound of submerged chains in her chest became a long, dry exhalation. Then something had brought her out of that deepening spiral and started her feeling along the wall in the cold darkness for the light switch. She got out of bed. She did not have strength enough left to do this. A doctor would have laughed at the idea. And yet she did. She fell back twice, then finally made it to her feet, mouth turned down in a snarl of effort. She groped for the chair, found it, and began to lurch her way across the room to the window. Lily Cavanaugh, Queen of the Bees, was gone. This was a walking horror, eaten by cancer, burned by rising fever. She reached the window and looked out. Saw a human shape down there and a glowing globe. "Jack!" she tried to scream. Nothing came out but a gravelly whisper. She raised a hand, tried to wave. Faintness washed over her. She clutched at the windowsill. "Jack!" Suddenly the lighted ball in the figure's hands flashed up brightly, illuminating his face, and it was Jack's face. It was Jack. Oh, thank God! It was Jack. Jack had come home. The figure broke into a run. "Jack!" Those sunken, dying eyes grew yet more brilliant. Tears spilled down her yellow, stretched cheeks. "Mom!" Jack ran across the lobby, seeing that the old-fashioned telephone switchboard was fused and blackened as if from an electrical fire, and instantly dismissing it. He had seen her, and she looked awful. It had been like looking at the silhouette of a scarecrow propped in the window. "Mom!" He pounded up the stairs, first by twos, then by threes, the talisman stuttering one burst of pink-red light, and then falling dark in his hands. "Mom!" Down the hallway to their rooms, feet flying, and now at last he heard her voice. No brassy bellow or slightly throaty chuckle now. This was the dusty croak of a creature on the outer edge of death.
"Jackie!"
"Mom!" He burst into the room. Down in the car, a nervous Richard Sloat stared upward through his polarized window. What was he doing here? What was Jack doing here? Richard's eyes hurt. He strained to see the upper windows in the murky evening. As he bent sideways and stared upward, a blinding white flash erupted from several of the upstairs windows, sending a momentary, almost palpable sheet of dazzling light over the entire front of the hotel. Richard put his head between his knees and moaned. She was on the floor, beneath the window. He saw her there, finally. The rumpled, somehow dusty-looking bed was empty. The whole bedroom, as disordered as a child's room, seemed empty. Jack's stomach had frozen and words backed up in his throat. Then the talisman had shot out another of its great, illuminating flashes, in and for an instant turning everything in the room a pure, colorless white. She croaked, "Jackie!" once more, and he bellowed, "Mom!" seeing her crumpled like a candy wrapper under the window. Thin and lank, her hair trailed on the room's dirty carpet. Her hands seemed like tiny animal paws, pale and scrabbling.
"Oh, Jesus, Mom! Oh, jeepers! Oh, holy mo!" he babbled,
and somehow moved across the room without taking a step. He floated, he swam across Lily's crowded, frozen bedroom in an instant that seemed as sharp to him as an image on a photographic plate. Her hair puddled on the grimy carpet, her small, knotty hands. He inhaled the thick odor of illness, of close death. Jack was no doctor, and he was ignorant of most of the things so wrong with Lily's body, but he knew one thing. His mother was dying. Her life was falling away through invisible cracks, and she had very little time left. She had uttered his name twice, and that was about all the life left in her would permit. Already beginning to weep, he put his hand on her unconscious head and set the talisman on the floor beside her. Her hair felt full of sand, and her head was burning.
"Oh, Mom, Mom," he said, and got his hands under her.
He still could not see her face. Through her flimsy nightgown, her hip felt as hot as the door of a stove. Against his other palm, her left shoulder blade pulsed with an equal warmth. She had no comfortable pads of flesh over her bones. For a mad second of stopped time, it was as though she were a small, dirty child somehow left ill and alone. Sudden, unbidden tears squirted out of his eyes. He lifted her, and it was like picking up a bundle of clothes. Jack moaned. Lily's arms sprawled loosely, gracelessly.
"Richard."
Richard had felt not as bad as this, not even when Richard had felt like a dried husk on his back, coming down the final hill into poisoned Point Venuti. There had been little but pimples and a rash left of Richard at that point, but he too had burned with fever. But Jack realized with a sort of unthinking horror that there had been more actual life, more substance to Richard than his mother now possessed. Still, she had called his name, and Richard had nearly died. She had called his name. He clung to that. She had made it to the window. She had called his name. It was impossible, unthinkable, immoral to imagine that she could die. One of her arms dangled before him like a reed meant to be cut in half by a scythe. Her wedding ring had fallen off her finger. He was crying steadily, unstoppably, unconsciously.
"Okay, Mom," he said. "Okay. It's okay now. Okay. It's okay."
From the limp body in his arms came a vibration that might have been a scent. He gently placed her on the bed, and she rolled weightlessly sideways. Jack put a knee on the bed and leaned over her. The tired hair fell away from her face. Once, at the very beginning of his journey, he had, for a shameful moment, seen his mother as an old woman, a spent, exhausted old woman in a tea shop. As soon as he had recognized her, the illusion had dissipated, and Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer had been restored to her unaging self. For the real, the true Lily Cavanaugh could never have aged. She was eternally a blonde with a quick switchblade of a smile and a go-to-hell amusement in her face. This had been the Lily Cavanaugh whose picture on a billboard had strengthened her son's heart. The woman on the bed looked very little like the actress on the billboard. Jack's tears momentarily blinded him.
"Oh, don't,
he said, and laid one palm across her yellowed cheek. She did not look as though she had enough strength to lift her hand. He took her tight, dry, discolored claw of a hand into his own hand.
"Please, please, please don't."
He could not even allow himself to say it. And then he realized how much an effort this shrunken woman had made. She had been looking for him, he understood, in a great, giddy rush of comprehension. His mother had known he was coming. She had trusted him to return, and in a way that must have been connected to the fact of the talisman itself. She had known the moment of his return.
"I'm here, Mom,"
he whispered. A wad of wet stuff bubbled from his nostrils. He unceremoniously wiped his nose with the sleeve of his coat. He realized for the first time that his entire body was trembling.
"I brought it back," he said.
He experienced a moment of absolute radiant pride, of pure accomplishment.
"I brought back the talisman," he said.
Gently he set her nut-like hand down on the counterpane. Beside the chair where he had placed it every bit as gently on the floor, the talisman continued to glow. But its light was faint, hesitant, cloudy. He had healed Richard by simply rolling the globe down the length of his friend's body. He had done the same for Speedy. But this was to be something else. He knew that, but not what it was to be, unless it was a question of knowing and not wanting to believe. He could not possibly break the talisman, not even to save his mother's life. That much he did know. Now the interior of the talisman slowly filled with a cloudy whiteness. The pulses faded into one another and became a single steady light. Jack placed his hands on it, and the talisman shot forth a blinding wall of light, rainbow, which seemed nearly to speak. At last! Jack went back across the room toward the bed, the talisman bouncing and spraying light from floor to wall to ceiling, illuminating the bed fitfully, garishly. As soon as he stood beside his mother's bed, the texture of the talisman seemed to Jack to subtly alter beneath his fingers. Its glassy hardness shifted, somehow, became less slippery, more porous. The tips of his fingers seemed almost to sink into the talisman. The cloudiness filling it boiled and darkened. And at this moment, Jack experienced a strong, in fact passionate feeling he would have thought was impossible that day long ago when he had set off for his first day's walk in the territories. He knew that in some unforeseen way the talisman, the object of so much blood and trouble, was going to alter. It was going to change forever, and he was going to lose it. The talisman would no longer be his. Its clear skin was clouding over too, and the entire beautiful, grooved, gravid surface was softening. The feeling now was not glass, but warming plastic. Jack hurriedly set the altering talisman down in his mother's hands. It knew its job. It had been made for this moment. In some fabulous smithy, it had been created to answer the requirements of this particular moment, and of none other. He did not know what he expected to happen. An explosion of light? A smell of medicine? Creation's big bang? Nothing happened. His mother continued visibly but motionlessly to die. "Oh, please," Jack blurted. "Please, Mom, please." His breath solidified in the middle of his chest. A seam, once one of the vertical grooves in the talisman, had soundlessly opened. Light slowly poured out and pooled over his mother's hands. From the cloudy interior of the loose, emptying ball, more light spilled through the open seam. From outside came a sudden and loud music of birds celebrating their existence. But of that Jack was only distractedly conscious. He leaned breathlessly forward and watched the talisman pour itself out onto his mother's bed. Cloudy brightness welled up within it. Seams and sparks of light enlivened it. His mother's eyes twitched. "Oh, Mom," he whispered. "Oh." Gray-golden light flooded through the opening in the talisman and cloudily drifted up his mother's arms. Her sallow, wizened face very slightly frowned. Jack inhaled unconsciously. What? Music? The gray-golden cloud from the heart of the talisman was lengthening over his mother's body, coating her in a translucent but slightly opaque, delicately moving membrane. Jack watched this fluid fabric slide across Lily's pitiful chest, down her wasted legs. From the open seam in the talisman, a wondrous odor spilled out with the gray-golden cloud, an odor sweet and unsweet, of flowers and earth, wholly good, yeasty. A smell of birth, Jack thought, though he had never attended an actual birth. Jack drew it into his lungs, and in the midst of his wonder was gifted with the thought that he himself, Jacko Sawyer, was being born at this minute. And then he imagined, with a barely perceptible shock of recognition, that the opening in the talisman was like a vagina. He had, of course, never seen a vagina, and had only the most rudimentary idea of its structure. Jack looked directly into the opening in the distended, loosened talisman. Now he became conscious for the first time of the incredible racket, in some way all mixed up with faint music, of the birds outside the dark windows. Music? What? A small colored ball, full of light, shot past his vision, flashing in the open seam for a moment, then continued beneath the talisman's cloudy surface as it dove into the shifting, moving, gaseous interior. Jack blinked. It had resembled another followed, and this time he had time to see the demarcation of blue and brown and green on the tiny globe, the coastal shorelines and tiny mountain ranges. On that tiny world, it occurred to him, stood a paralyzed Jack Sawyer looking down at an even tinier colored speck, and on that speck stood a Jacko the height of a dust mote staring at a little world the size of an atom. Another world followed the first two, spinning in, out of the widening cloud within the talisman. His mother moved her right hand and moaned. Jack began openly to weep. She would live. He knew it now. All had worked as Speedy had said, and the talisman was forcing life back into his mother's exhausted, disease-ridden body, killing the evil that was killing her. He bent forward, for a moment almost giving in to the image of himself kissing the talisman which filled his mind. The odors of jasmine and hibiscus and freshly overturned earth filled his nostrils. A tear rolled off the end of his nose and sparkled like a jewel in the shafts of light from the talisman. He saw a belt of stars drift past the open seam, a beaming yellow sun swimming in vast black space. Music seemed to fill the talisman, the room, the whole world outside. A woman's face, the face of a stranger, moved across the open seam. Children's faces, too, then the faces of other women. Tears rolled down his own face, for he had seen swimming in the talisman his mother's own face, the confident, wise-cracking, tender features of the queen of half a hundred quick movies. When he saw his own face drifting among all the worlds and lives falling toward birth within the talisman, he thought he would burst with feeling. He expanded, he breathed in light, and became at last aware of the astonishment of noises taking place all about him when he saw his mother's eyes stay open as long at least as a blessed 2 seconds. For alive as birds, as alive as the worlds contained within the talisman, there came to him the sounds of trombones and trumpets, the cries of saxophones, the joined voices of frogs and turtles and gray doves singing, "The people who know my magic have filled the land with smoke." There came to him the voices of wolves making wolf music at the moon. Water spanked against the bow of a ship, and a fish spanked the surface of a lake with the side of its body, and a rainbow spanked the ground, and a traveling boy spanked a drop of spittle to tell him which way to go, and a spanked baby squinched its face and opened its throat, and there came the huge voice of an orchestra singing with its whole massive heart. And the room filled with the smoky trail of a single voice rising and rising and rising over all these forays of sound. Trucks jammed gears and factory whistles blew, and somewhere a tire exploded and somewhere a firecracker loudly spent itself, and a lover whispered again, and a child squalled, and the voice rose and rose, and for a short time Jack was unaware that he could not see, but then he could again. Lily's eyes opened wide. They stared up into Jack's face with a startled "Where am I?" expression. It was the expression of a newborn infant who has just been spanked into the world. Then she jerked in a startled breath, and a river of worlds and tilted galaxies and universes were pulled up and out of the talisman as she did. They were pulled up in a stream of rainbow colors. They streamed into her mouth and nose. They settled, gleaming on her sallow skin like droplets of dew, and melted inward. For a moment his mother was all clothed in radiance. For a moment his mother was the talisman. All the disease fled from her face. It did not happen in the manner of a time-lapse sequence in a movie. It happened all at once. It happened instantly. She was sick, and then she was well. Rosy, good health bloomed in her cheeks. Wispy, sparse hair was suddenly full and smooth and rich, the color of dark honey. Jack stared at her as she looked up into his face.
"Oh, oh, my God," Lily whispered.
That rainbow radiance was fading now, but the health remained. "Mom?" He bent forward. Something crumpled like cellophane under his fingers. It was the brittle husk of the talisman. He put it aside on the night table. He pushed several of her medicine bottles out of the way to do it. Some crashed on the floor, and it didn't matter. She would not be needing the medicines anymore. He put the husk down with gentle reverence, suspecting, no, knowing, that even that would be gone very soon. His mother smiled. It was a lovely, fulfilled, somewhat surprised smile. "Hello, world, here I am again. What do you know about that?"
"Jack, you came home," she said at last, and rubbed her eyes as if to make sure it was no mirage.
"Sure," he said. He tried to smile. It was a pretty good smile in spite of the tears that were pouring down his face.
"Sure, you bet. I feel a lot better, Jacko."
"Yeah?" He smiled, rubbed his wet eyes with the heels of his palms.
"That's good, Mom."
Her eyes were radiant.
"Hug me, Jackie."
In a room on the fourth floor of a deserted resort hotel on the minuscule New Hampshire seacoast, a 13-year-old boy named Jack Sawyer leaned forward, closed his eyes, and hugged his mother tightly, smiling. His ordinary life of school and friends and games and music, a life where there were schools to go to and crisp sheets to slide between at night, the ordinary life of a 13-year-old boy, if the life of such a creature can ever in its color and riot be considered ordinary, had been returned to him, he realized. The talisman had done that for him, too. When he remembered to turn and look for it, the talisman was gone. Epilogue. In a billowing white bedroom filled with anxious women, Laura DeLoessian, Queen of the Territories, opened her eyes. Conclusion. So endeth this chronicle. It being strictly the history of a boy, it must stop here. The story could not go much further without becoming the history of a man. When one writes a novel about grown people, he knows exactly where to stop, that is, with a marriage. But when he writes of juveniles, he must stop where he best can. Most of the characters who perform in this book still live and are prosperous and happy. Some day it may seem worthwhile to take up the story again and see what they turned out to be. Therefore, it will be wisest not to reveal any of that part of their lives at present. Mark Twain, Tom Sawyer.
The Talisman was written by Stephen King and Peter Straub and read by Frank Muller. Post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Sally Hurst. The Talisman was produced by Frank Muller. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Stephen King's Dreamcatcher, read by Jeffrey DeMunn, and LT's Theory of Pets, read by the author.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.